Good morning, everybody. This first case this morning is case number 62108, Julius Bradford versus the State of Nevada. Ms. Rasmussen for the appellant, Ms. Pressy for the respondent. This is a 60-minute argument.
Good morning, Chief Justice Cherry, members of the Nevada Supreme Court. My name is Lisa Rasmussen. I represent Julius Bradford. May I please the court and opposing counsel? I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and I will keep an eye on my clock.
Can I trouble you to speak up just a little bit? I'm already having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Nobody's ever accused me of talking loud enough, and I have no problem.
I'm sure it's me.
It's mostly me trying to calm myself down. I raised several issues on behalf of Mr. Bradford in this appeal, and the most substantial one is the brass and Batson issue, so I'm going to start with that. In this case, there was an opportunity during voir dire and during our exercise of peremptory challenges for my co-counsel and I to make one Batson challenge in front of the district court. And then after that, we were denied the opportunity to make two additional Batson challenges. I went to great lengths to get that record before this court, as the court probably knows from the pleadings in this case, and the state agreed to basically what we filed in the supplement, which was what was reflected on the video. And I don't know if this court has looked at the video or not. But what happened was we asked to make our second Batson challenge. We were denied the opportunity. Really didn't know kind of what to do for a minute, and it was clear that the court was not going to hear us. And then we continued doing our peremps and passing our paper back and forth. And then the third time it happened, we asked to be heard, and were denied the opportunity to be heard. And then when the paper was complete, we again said we needed to be heard. The court then proceeded to dismiss the jurors on the paper, two of which were challenged jurors by us, but not heard yet. One Batson challenge was heard. And then the court dismissed those jurors, sent them downstairs, and told all the remaining jurors that they would be seated and to come back on Monday. This was a Wednesday.
Did you ask to approach the bench and tell the judge you wanted to make your challenge heard before he dismissed these jurors then? Or how did that interplay happen?
When we were finished with the paper and handed it to the bailiff, said we need to be heard again. We made that abundantly clear.
To the judge?
Yes. Well, to the bailiff, to tell the judge. And I, you know, if there's any... I guess I have to sort of explain. It's a pretty hostile environment in that department, and we don't do anything without permission from the bailiff. And just as in any courtroom, I would certainly never get up from the table and approach the bench without permission. I wouldn't enter the well of the court without
permission. You ask the bailiff and not the judge if you approach the bench? I mean, I never heard of anything like that.
Well, Judge Smith was talking. And he was talking to the jurors, and we don't interrupt him when he's talking.
Okay.
So he handed the paper to the bailiff and said we needed to be heard. And I think it was a matter of I wouldn't have interrupted him. We went to great lengths to have our Batson challenges heard. And we were denied the opportunity. And he dismissed the jurors, told them to come back, you know, was reading off names, and then said, when everyone was gone, now you want to be heard. And we made our Batson challenges. I made the record then that I had wanted to be heard, but I had Batson challenges to make. But as in Brass, which had not come out yet, that decision came out, I think, 3 months later. It's pretty much a foregone conclusion that our Batson challenges are going to be denied. I mean, the only remedy, which would have been acceptable to us, but I can assure you it would not have been to Judge Smith, was to start all over if he had granted a Batson challenge.
In this particular case, setting aside at some points Judge Smith, The argument that's being made against your position is that we should treat this as almost like a harmless error, structural but harmless, if possible. What's your position? Why is that not an appropriate approach?
I think it's untenable. I think it doesn't match the facts of the case. I think that this case is worse than Brass. This is a better Brass case than Brass, if you will. The facts in Brass were one juror and an attempt to make a Batson challenge. They were told they could do it during a break, and then during the break, the court dismissed that juror. And this court found that that was structural error, didn't do a harmless error analysis, and the state's position or suggestion that we do some kind of, it was accidental, it wasn't intentional, I don't even think that matches the facts of this case. I really don't. It was quite clear.
Question on Brass, and I'm not sure. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Brass was a 1-1-1 case. There was an opinion by Justice Douglas that addresses the concerns you're talking about, which is, did this judge exhibit that he had made his mind up already to reject your Batson challenge, and was that a fundamental structural error? That was where he came out, and I understand that. We have Justice Gibbons writing separately, but joining Justice Douglas. And then we have Justice Perry concurring in the result only, so I'm not sure what his reasoning was on that. But it caught my eye preparing for today's argument. How do we treat the precedent of Brass when we're convened as an en banc court? And I'm not saying Brass was wrong, but I'm just, is it mandatory precedent? Are we free to revisit it? Do you have any comments on that? And then I have a second question when you're done with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
So my comment on that, and I looked at that also, petition for rehearing was filed by the state in Brass and was denied by the full court. That I looked at that as well. I do not think that it is, I don't think that because there's seven of you, I noticed there's actually six of you today.
Justice Perry will be participating.
Okay. So. I don't think that because I'm arguing this to the full court that that is a reason to revisit a three-judge panel prior results that all three panelists in that case concurred with. They concurred with the result.
Yeah, I haven't found any law in Nevada that kind of rummaged. I looked at it and couldn't find anything. But
I think with any decision, this court is always free to revisit any of its prior opinions. But I think in response to where does that fit in with this case? That's why I go back to saying I think this case is a better Brass case than Brass.
Well, yeah. Can I ask you this? I know this is bigger as another question, but and this is the key issue for me in the case is the state is saying that Brass was wrong because we said it was structural and that shouldn't be the analysis, and then they go through it, and whether it was a three justice or seven, I mean, if we're wrong, we're wrong, you know, like that. I mean, but we all felt we were right, I guess, at the time. So what? Tell us why you feel it is structural and Brass was correct versus applying a harmless error analysis.
Okay.
And let me put in my question. I'm sorry to double up on you.
It's okay.
But it fits with what he just asked. In some of the U.S. Supreme Court Batson cases, you'll see years after the fact they go back and reconstruct what happened in the Batson challenge and whether or not the exclusion was racially motivated by the state in a way that Batson does not permit or countenance. And so there is a mechanism in the law for going back after the fact if a juror is excused who should not have been because the prosecutor was engaging in intentional racial discrimination, and let's take races, in making that challenge and you can prove it. The Texas case, I think it was recently, where the prosecutor's notes were so unacceptable. If you can go back after the fact and prove it like that, how can it be, why would we call it structural? To me, you could say these two jurors in your case And you could have a whole evidentiary hearing, and I think Miller L. had an evidentiary hearing on what was the prosecutor doing when he exercised the, or she exercised the challenges. If you can establish after the fact that there was no, or that there was racial discrimination, it doesn't matter which way it goes, but you could hold an evidentiary hearing after the fact with the prosecutor and the recused juror, and you can determine that there was no racial discrimination or animus underlying that challenge. Why would we call this structural error? That's the other question I had as I was getting ready today, but it fits sort of...
Okay, and I'm trying to remember Justice Gibbons' question.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I think I can respond to this. I'll start with the structural error issue. I think in answer to your question that those are habeas proceedings where people are having evidentiary hearings after the fact, because
they
that's
are.
What we do in habeas proceedings. I'm here on direct appeal. It's one distinction. We obviously cite to those cases because those cases are Supreme Court precedent. That is the law of the land. Batson is structural because it creates an equal protection violation. It's a denial of a 14th Amendment right, but it is also structural because it infects the proceedings and it creates a scenario where it doesn't afford an opportunity to even allow us to analyze whether it was a fair proceeding. We can't sit here today and analyze whether the proceeding and the trial for Julius Bradford was fair because we don't know what would have happened differently with those two jurors had my challenges been sustained. And it's structural because it infects that proceeding, leaves us without the ability to make an analysis.
And that's kind of assuming the prosecutor had invidious discrimination. Because if you had a Batson, it's not just a challenge, but a solid, if the judge credits a Batson challenge, yes, I agree with you. But here we don't know whether the judge, a neutral judge, would have credited that challenge or not. And so is that something that can be reconstructed after the fact? Did that prosecutor engage in impermissible racial discrimination in making those challenges? Why isn't that something left for habeas that really isn't structural because it's provable and knowable? We don't know whether there was...
Justice Pickering, I would ask that you rephrase your question slightly because... In this situation, we are not asserting, or it's not being asserted, that the state is being pretextual at one point. It is at a second point, but it's not the first point. The question is whether or not the judge is doing what their gatekeeper function is.
Right. And that's fair. That's what I'm struggling with, is the judge's failure to exercise that gatekeeper function structural. I get that Batson, if proven, is structural. But the gatekeeper question, that's the issue. Thank you, Justice Douglas.
And I think I go back to Brass. This court decided in Brass that what happened in that case was basically it set up a situation where it was a foregone conclusion. There was no... The court had already dismissed the juror. The court wasn't going to sustain a Batson challenge. It's no different in this case, and we have it with two different jurors in this case. And the Batson challenges, I mean, I did the comparative juror analysis. Those are equally reversible issues, in my opinion, if the court wants to talk about those. I don't think that either of those jurors... I don't think the state gave a race-neutral reason getting to the substance of Batson on either of those jurors to begin with. But to be precluded from the opportunity to make a Batson challenge, and Brass had not come out. This was not some gamesmanship on our part of, you know, saying, well, we'll just, you know, have this messed up record. Not at all. You know, I can assure the court that we went to great lengths to try to get the court's attention. In any other courtroom, frankly, our, you know, standing up and speaking to the bailiff would have alerted the judge that that we needed to be heard. It was obvious what we were doing. We were doing peremptory challenges. We had already made one Batson challenge. There couldn't really be a mistake as to why we needed to be heard.
And your point is, why is it fair that Mr. Bradford's case gets heard second and then we wouldn't apply it, but Brass on the same record?
Well, I don't think there should be a Julius Bradford exception to equal protection under the 14th Amendment, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That wouldn't make sense to me, and I think that this case is as egregious as Brass. This court reversed in Brass, but this court also noted in Brass a couple of things. One is that there is potentially a violation of judicial canons in the manner that the matter was resolved in Brass, and that also applies to my case because it indicates a judicial bias. It indicates a predisposition to deny the challenge anyway, no matter what the challenge would be. He simply didn't want to hear it. It gives that air. So it's certainly structural because there's no way I can go back with jury issues. That's why Batson issues are almost always structural. There's no way I can go back and say this would have been a different result with a different one or two different jurors.
Was it in the record, or is it an issue where the judge swore in the veneer at the beginning of the case here?
Thank you, Justice.
I mean, it's in the record. I just wanted to...
I did not raise it, and that is a mistake that I made in this appeal, but they were not sworn at the beginning. I looked at whether they were sworn before they were seated, and they were, but not at the beginning. So that is yet another error that would come at a later date if this court doesn't reverse this case now. Does the court want me to address the other issues that I have raised?
Well, I would like you to address the two jurors. My question is, following along the conversation we've been having here, as part of the structural error analysis, you raised the issue of fairness. In a death penalty case we're hearing tomorrow, that question is front and center in determining the application of structural error to this context. In this case, the parties do argue and take different positions about what happened or how Batson would have come out once there was a hearing eventually on 906, 920, and 931 juror numbers.
Correct.
I think it's important maybe to hear from you on that point, and I am hoping that the state will comment on that as well, because if at the end of the day, the analysis of those jurors viewed by the court is that there wouldn't have been any basis for a Batson challenge, then can you claim a Batson error?
Well, I'll talk about those three jurors, but I don't think that that was any part of the analysis in Brass. I mean, the whole issue with Brass is that we don't know what the court would have done because the court had no option really other than to just deny the Batson challenge because the juror was already gone. The only remedy at that point for both of us, Brass and my case, was to start all over. And that wasn't going to happen, I can assure you, in the department that I was in. With regard to juror 906, that was the first juror. And I think he was the one, unless I'm getting them confused, that said on his questionnaire that he smoked marijuana. Mr. Pesci is reminding me, we had lots of fun together in this room. His only reason, or the reason that the state indicated that he was wishy-washy on some of his death answers, and they brought up the fact that he smoked marijuana, but then they were quick to concede that that was not a basis simply to strike him. That was Batson challenge number one. Batson challenge number two was a...
Well, before we leave juror 906,
yes.
I recognize the jurors gone, all three of these, but you're discussing the record that was made in front of the judge. What is problematic with respect to the state's decision to preemptory challenge this juror when on the questionnaire they indicate they are smoking marijuana?
Because there were other people who indicated that they smoked marijuana, did not have any issues whatsoever with marijuana, who were white, and the state did not move to strike them or challenge them for cause in any way. In fact, the state didn't challenge juror 906 for cause, but there were similarly situated white jurors who answered the same type, the same question, and indicated that they, for example, there was one white juror, and I cited it in the record, who indicated that he had no problem. He had problems with drugs except marijuana. That was not a problem to the state, but this African-American juror who indicated that he smoked marijuana was a problem to the state.
Okay.
The next one
920.
Was 920. She indicated that she was a stay-at-home mom. She, you know, worried about serving on the jury because of that. On this one, and I think on this one, the state gave a reason, and then the court gave its own reason, which had nothing to do with what the state said. And the court's reason was that because she indicated she puts her kids in timeout as a means of punishment. That was a reason that the court gave, which was had nothing to do with anything the state had cited as a race-neutral reason. Again, putting your kids in timeout certainly is not a race-neutral reason. With regard, and I think she had also, she had parents in law enforcement, I believe. I mean, there was really nothing wrong with that juror. It doesn't even make sense, other than she had just, you know, some normal questions about the gravity of imposing the death penalty. Juror number 931 was a ethnic African-American from Tanzania, I believe. He indicated that he was aware that public defenders were sometimes underfunded and that the criminal justice system had some inherent racial bias that came along with the system. And he was aware of that, and he also indicated he had read a Department of Justice study. That was the reason the state cited for wanting to excuse him, and that's not a race-neutral reason either, that he read a study has, you know, really no bearing. He wasn't expressing an opinion either way. He never indicated that he could not impose the death penalty. For practical matters, we aren't public defenders. We were appointed counsel. I'm in private practice. So was my co-counsel, Susan Firk. It really had nothing to do with anything. The state's explanation for that was not race neutral, but more importantly, there were other white people who also indicated that they thought public defenders were underfunded, and that there were white people who showed animus toward public defenders and thought that they did a horrible job and that they were losers and that they were snaky, and there were all kinds of responses like that on the questionnaires, which showed a true bias toward public defenders. And here's a guy who's just saying, I think they're underfunded, and that was not a race-neutral reason either. I'm gonna try and reserve some of my time, but I wanna really, I think your questions were important, Justice Hardesty, but I also wanna remind the court that this case, we were never allowed to ask even race questions on the jury questionnaire. And I think we all know from our experiences in trials that people are more likely to give honest answers about matters of race and matters of bias in a questionnaire in a written setting where they're not saying it out loud in a courtroom.
Well, you were actually denied that right by Judge Herndon, who then said, oh, don't worry about it, you can do it during voir dire, and then Judge Smith did allow it anyway.
And then when we went to Judge Smith, he had no idea. He specifically told us he had not spoken to Judge Herndon at all and didn't know anything, including any of the prior rulings that Judge Smith had made, Judge Herndon had made, that had bearing on the trial we were about to embark on.
You have about 5.5 minutes left. You want to say that?
Question.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay.
As Justice Pickering's question indicated, there is a lot of waxing waning on the Batson challenge and its application or its remedy as a structural remedy. Should this court evaluate this issue under the Nevada Constitution separately from the United States Constitution in your assessment?
I think this court should evaluate it under both the Nevada State Constitution and the United States Constitution, 14th Amendment.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to give you a couple extra minutes because I need to ask about cumulative error. We've heard some remarks that you've made that that even if we look at harmless error in some of these things, what about cumulative error on this death penalty case?
Thank you.
No, wait, I want...
Well, you want to ask it now?
Right, now I'll give you some extra minutes and I'll give Mr. Pesci some extra time.
I will address it now, okay. Okay, so the...
Death is different in this...
death is different. Death is always different. So we have what I perceive and think this court has agreed with in Brass to be a structural error. This court has, and it's not just Brass, this court has also found Batson issues to be reversible. This court has found not swearing the jury to be reversible. I know that's not an issue that I raised, but I told you that it did happen in this case. The combination of the comparative juror analysis, the different treatment by the state of white jurors versus black jurors, the scrutiny, the heightened scrutiny applied to African-American jurors compared to white jurors, the failure to allow us to probe on race in a meaningful way, all tie in, and this case also was about race. I didn't talk about that, but it was always about race. Julius Bradford and Aaron Daniels were the two African Americans charged with this crime. There were five people involved. There was Natasha Barker, who pled and testified against them. There was Justin Brown, white, and Bobby Harwell, Natasha's boyfriend, white. Two white people never charged. Aaron Daniels and Julius Bradford, black, were charged. And Natasha is Hispanic. She was charged and she pled. Race, this case was always about race. It was never not about race. And that was why we were so upset that we weren't allowed to have the questions in the questionnaire and we were given all the assurances. There are other issues that I raised, Justice Cherry, that go to whether the death penalty is constitutional in Nevada. I suspect those issues are probably not going to carry the day. But what I do think carries the day in a cumulative error sense are all of these race things that I'm talking about and all of these errors with regard to something so fundamental as having a fair trial and a jury.
I'll give you an extra 5 minutes, which means you'll have 7 minutes or 7 minutes and 46 seconds for rebuttal. And Mr. Pesci, I'll give you 35 minutes.
Thank you.
If you need it.
Justices, my name is Giancarlo Pesci. I am the attorney for the respondent for the state of Nevada. I'm going to try to answer the questions that have been brought up. Am I being loud enough?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Tell me if I'm not, please. I'm going to try to start with you, Justice Pickering. You were asking, in essence, the structural versus non-structural issues in Brass. What I'd ask your honor to do, to all of you to do, is go to the decision in Brass. Let's just start with the decision itself. Specifically, this court, whether it's 1-1-1 or 3, indicated the following. Dismissing a prospective juror prior to holding the Batson hearing had the same effect as racially discriminatory peremptory challenge because even if the defendants were able to prove purposeful discrimination, they would be left with limited recourse. Now there's a footnote, footnote 5. And the court says, we note that if the district court held the Batson hearing prior to excusing a prospective juror 173 and it found purposeful discrimination, recourse would not be needed. Possible remedies could include allowing her to remain in the jury pool, discharging the entire veneer, and selecting a new jury, or calling additional jurors to the veneer and granting additional peremptory challenges. What's key, this court in determining Brass says, Batson itself, and then it also says, see Kasten v. Costello, and gives a pinpoint site specifically to page 271 in Kasten v. Costello. In that case, which was a foundational aspect of the decision in Brass, says the following, specifically at page 271. Batson itself recognized two appropriate remedies for a Batson violation, the discharge of the veneer and commencement anew of jury selection, or two, the disallowance of the discriminatory challenge and resumption of the jury selection with those jurors reinstated to the veneer. Here's the Here's where it's critical. If reinstatement of the improperly challenged veneer persons is not possible because they have already been discharged, sounds familiar, doesn't it? A court may call additional jurors to the veneer and grant the defendant additional peremptory challenges. If, in fact, there were structural error, that opportunity of a remedy would not be possible because that would be continuing the structural error. It's not structural error.
Mr. Pesci, can I ask you, and it's hard to hear who's speaking here, but it sounds like Ms. Rasmussen said the bailiff shut her down when she was trying to raise these issues. She might have moved for a mistrial. She might have done some other things, maybe pursued that remedy, but it looks like she was just cut off. So how should we take that into consideration?
I would say we need to put in context to some degree the fact that there are three peremptory challenges that we just spoke of. You had the numbers just as far as the 906, 920, and 931. One of those was actually heard prior to them being released. There were two that were heard after being released. So the defense was able to make an approach and get the court's attention and ask for a Batson hearing, and the Batson hearing was conducted. Subsequent to that, as the court was reading the instructions to the jury, trying to move the process along, state concedes. Defense counsel attempted to get the court's attention in order to make these two. Mm-hmm. But we take no issue with that. We're not trying to change the record. We understand that. We conceded that when we saw the jacks. I understand that there's the problem there and that they should be able to be heard. They were heard. It's the timing question. And my response is, if in fact it's not structural, the timing is not faulty to the point of making it be reversed. That's the key. And that's why I just pointed to this case that I just recited, because it provided for a remedy if in fact what happened in our case happens.
So we should overrule Brass, in your opinion?
I think you should retreat from Brass.
Same thing, isn't it?
Yes. Remedies in Brass are referenced by Brass that are referenced in the other case are not available when the veneer is released. And wasn't that the case with respect to the final two jurors?
Those two jurors were released, yes, Justice Hornsby. I believe, though,
I thought the jury was seated and sworn.
Yes.
So when this effort was trying to be made. So the remedies referenced in Brass's footnote are no longer available.
Well, to some degree, I think that they are, because in the footnotes case, the Kasten case, the jury had been impaneled, and the 12 had been picked. And so then there was a back and forth between the state and in that case as to whether it was too late because the 12th one was put in place. And the court said that it wasn't too late and you could provide this remedy. Here's my response to you. I don't understand why we accept the concept that there's no remedy. We got these jurors into the courthouse to begin with. We can bring them back. We have a summons that's been issued. We have a name. We have an address. They can be brought back. It is not impossible to do that. Is it the best practice? Absolutely not. Should we do it this way? No, we shouldn't. Keep in mind that your decision was in December of 2012, before this actually occurred. We were in trial in July and August. And so I believe there are remedies, and this case law actually speaks.
Well, part of the reason why I asked about the analysis on the two jurors who were excused, because if the court were to disagree with the judge's evaluation of the race-neutral basis and the discriminatory effect of their peremptory challenge, the remedy issue isn't there. There's still a Batson violation.
I understand that. And I'll try to respond to that. Specifically as to 906, 920, and then I'll go to 931, Justice. In 906, the prospective juror in volume 19 of the Record on Appeal, page 4074, it is the questionnaire. And by the way, the questionnaire actually states at the beginning, you're hereby placed under oath. So there was a comment earlier about oath. There is actually, in the front page of the questionnaires, I'd ask you to look at that, you'll see that. But this person stated in the questionnaire, in response to question 12, here's the question. Have you, or anyone close to you, ever had a street drug, prescription drug, or alcohol problem? That's the question. Not your opinion about drugs. Have you had a problem? Answer, yes. And then writes in on his own, I smoke cannabis daily, but I don't think it's a problem. Now, the state of Nevada did raise this issue in context of this particular person in response to the Batson challenge. It is a huge problem for the state of Nevada to have somebody who admits to smoking marijuana daily, who has said that they've had a problem. In 2012, marijuana was still illegal. We have an individual who's stating on the record that they smoke it daily. We don't let someone drive a car who smokes marijuana. Why would we let someone decide the life and death of a defendant who smokes marijuana daily? That has absolutely nothing to do with the race of the individual. It's the state's concern about someone who says, I've had a problem with drugs, and I smoke them daily. But I don't know.
It's the real concern whether or not they smoked an illegal substance or whether they could be fair and impartial in making the decision as to the charges in the case.
I have a concern. I had it then. I have it now for someone who states that they commit a crime daily and that they would be on our jury.
That wasn't my question. My question was, what is your concern? Is it whether or not they can be fair and impartial as the charges before the court, or in essence, their personal hygiene?
I think they cannot be fair and impartial. That's my concern, because someone who's smoking daily, I don't think is in a position to be able to assess the evidence.
And as to the other question, when you were talking about Reese putting jurors back in place, does the state then take the position that if the two jurors that were struck were minority jurors, that the state would acquiesce to the replacement jurors only being minority jurors so it equals what was previously there?
If the appellant asked for that, that'd be something we could argue about. That could be something that could happen. I mean, I don't know that it mandates that, but
well, this is a question in terms of what we're looking at. The projection of being fair and impartial. We start with the fair and impartial. Whatever draw we get, and you work with it. And as I indicated before, this was not, the state didn't cause this. The judge caused this. But when you're fashioning a remedy, you threw out this remedy. Well, we could have inserted more jurors. Well, this was the point. Two minority jurors were struck. Do you guarantee that they get a chance to have the two minority, another two minority jurors? Or you say, oh, well, you just get whatever comes in the door.
Oh, I think that's appropriate.
You think it's appropriate?
Sure. It's appropriate that you could bring back two minorities. And then each side will have an opportunity to find out if that individual is fair for this trial. Because whether you're a minority or not doesn't mean you're necessarily fair or not.
Oh, I understand that, but you would agree that if that was the case.
I think that's appropriate. I see nothing wrong with that. Going on to 920, by the way, 906 was Hispanic, is my recollection, not African American. 920 was also Hispanic. She indicated in her questionnaire, 19th volume, Record on Appeal, 4093, question 31, in answer to the question about the death penalty, she said, I believe in it generally, but I could not participate in any legal process. Then she went on and asked if you believe in the death penalty. She says yes and no. And she says yes because some crimes are so bad. And then she says no because, quote, not our decision to make. Now, vacillating on whether you can impose the death penalty is a race-neutral and an acceptable reason for dismissing someone, especially when the person compares the death penalty to time out. And in fact, the state did raise issues with her analogy of timeout, that she puts her kids in timeout. She even said, sometimes I think it's more of a punishment to spank them. It's the easy way out to give them physical or corporal punishment. So she's equating the easy way out in this case, as I hear, with something less than death. I need someone who can consider the death penalty, someone who says they don't believe in it, they could not participate in it, and compares it to time out is not someone that the state of Nevada wants. And we had the right, on that basis, to remove her. Her position had nothing to do with her race. It had to do with who she is. It's people's position on penalty that drives our decision, not their race, not their sex, not their religion, not that that's even covered. Moving on to 931. Henry, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, I think it's Capernaum. He was African American. He said unequivocally in his questionnaire, 19th volume, Record on Appeal, 4101, question, do you believe in the death penalty? Answer, no. Then he wrote in on his own, the death penalty is brutality. Now, for the record, nobody said the death penalty is brutality, but this individual. Now, did other people talk about how it could be severe and things of that nature?
Yes.
No one said that but him. Nobody said, I smoke marijuana daily, except for 906. And nobody said, this is like putting my kid in timeout, except for 920. There was no one who said that. Now, there were other people who said that they don't necessarily have an issue with drugs. And I was asking questions about if it were a drug case, would you be able to follow the law, even if you think the drug should be allowed? That was a different part of the question. What was unequivocal was that individual smoked it daily. 931 said, that's death penalty is brutality, that's the question. In court, questions were asked by my co-counsel, Pam Werkerly, and she said, you said death penalty was brutality, following up. And he responded, yes, that's my personal opinion. That opinion is his right to have, absolutely. But we have a right to keep someone off the jury who thinks that the death penalty is brutality, or else we really don't have someone who can consider all four possible forms of punishment.
Yes. And you agree it's problematic that the judge ruled prior to hearing any of these arguments, because that's effectively what he did. He decided the motion and then took the evidence. You agree that's problematic?
I believe that it was very problematic this time, yes.
All right, now you're asking the court to back away from Brass. Brass was a panel decision, and I disagree with Ms. Rasmussen. There was a request for a rehearing of the panel, but there was never a request that the en banc panel, that we sit en banc and reconsider Brass. Now Batson expressly is left to the states how best to implement its finding. In Brass, it's really a question of whether it's a Batson issue or because of the judge evincing this bias, pre-deciding the issue, whether or not that affects the fairness of the proceedings. Why should we back away from Brass? This is on all fours with Brass. It's 4 years old. It's a principle that's going to be difficult to measure on the outcome, so it seems to fall into the category of structural error. Why doesn't Brass resolve this?
Well, I think it resolves it, obviously, if it maintains its position as the law. And that's why the state's asking to undo it. And I think that it should be undone or retreated from, because of that, as I pointed out before, the very cases cited to create that opinion don't call it structural and actually provide for a remedy would be less than structural. And I think, if I'm hearing correctly, to some degree, you're talking about the bias of the judge and how we got here is based on that bias. And I accept and I understand that. I'd like to kind of shed some light on the bias of that judge in the context of peremptory challenges and in the context of challenges for cause. And hopefully this answers your question to some degree. The assumption is that this judge was just trying to just do what the state wanted, or at least I think that's the assumption. It's telling when we look at a challenge for cause raised by the defense. See, I think this is critical because when you assess whether I and Ms. Weckerly are racist, because that's what this is, that's what a Batson challenge is. I think the party that's alleging that should really not throw stones when they, in fact, have moved to strike an African American. And the judge in this case, going through that bias, prior to what you just described, so I think that sheds light on what happened later on, they challenged for cause one of the two African Americans that were seated. The defense did. The state objected. We fought to keep that juror, and we wanted that juror because he's strong on penalty. The court said, as they were making their challenge for cause, after the state objected, this is volume 10, page 1997, the court, I'm not going to kick him for cause. I don't think that it's clear to the court that he won't consider it. That was in the context of questions by defense counsel in regards to mitigation. The way the question was asked, I think, was improper, and we'll move on from here. I'm not going to kick him for cause. Then, the court says on page 198, besides, he's African-American, and you made a big deal of the fact that we didn't have enough African-Americans on there. And so that problem would have, and they, in the state, would probably have a motion on that as well, that they're trying to kick people off that are of color. This is the district court judge keeping an African-American on this jury in the face of the appellant's efforts to get rid of it.
Actually, I interpret Justice Stiglitz's question slightly different. I don't know that her point is, doesn't the judge's ruling on these jurors after they've already left and he's engaged in this process create an appearance of impropriety? I mean, can we really have faith that these were unbiased adjudications of these two jurors in particular when he's recognizing that he hadn't afforded the defense the opportunity to do this properly before the jurors were impaneled and the rest were dismissed?
I definitely can see it's problematic. I'm sorry. And I understand that it can give that appearance, and that's precisely why I read it.
Without getting into the comparison of whether the judge is being racially biased or not racially biased, the bigger problem that I think Justice Stiglitz's question raises for me is the judge just simply trying to cover his or her tracks when they're making an important decision on these jurors later, when the horse is out of the barn.
I understand the question, and I cannot dress it up so that it factually went different.
I know. You're put in a very difficult position here, Mr. Pesci. I appreciate the point.
Thank you. And I read this, Justice Stiglitz, to try to respond to that in essence. I think that sheds light on what happened on those two challenges after the fact. Because if, in fact, this was someone who was racially biased, the judge, that is, I don't think he would have earlier. I think you have a question.
I'm sorry. Why didn't the state object when the judge did not deal with the Batson challenges before he let the jury go?
That's a wonderful question. I'd like to try to put it in context. I think if you can think back to your days as district court judges, and then you're in the process of selecting a jury, and this particular courtroom, the methodology utilized is a piece of paper, and it's passed back and forth. And if I could turn around, from this table to that table. And so at that time, my co-counsel's focus is who we're going to have. And so I have to be honest with you. I didn't see out of the periphery what Ms. Rasmussen did or tried to do. And originally when it was brought up, I said, I don't remember, Lisa. But if we get the jabs, we'll understand. I remember them trying to do a Batson challenge. I do remember that, but I couldn't remember the specifics because I'm focused on trying to pick a jury. I'm writing down who it was we just exercised, passing it off, and then getting back from them who it is, and then looking at the jury and figuring out, okay, who's gone? Where's 12 at this point? Who's going to be next? And so I didn't even see this happen. And so that's an answer to your question. I don't know if it's one that's really good, but it's factually accurate. And that's why we didn't take issue with it when the jabs was attacked.
It's not raising Justice Gibbons had brought it up. Why didn't the state object when he failed to swear the veneer? Is that because that's what he does and everybody knows that he refuses to swear the panel? I mean, why is that? You have two actors in the court who are trying to ensure a fair trial, and that's supposed to give us double comfort. The two grown-ups are paying attention even if the judge has gone astray. Why did the state object to that?
My answer to that is going to speculate because I'm not exactly sure, but I believe that the swearing in the panel was similar to the situation we are in right now, which was brass had not been decided yet. And so the state of Nevada, but the prosecution, didn't know, hey, he's going to foul with that. And I believe the case that determined swearing in had not happened. I could be wrong.
But the statute requires it.
Right, but as far as it having been brought up, and it wasn't on my radar. Mm-hmm. And I apologize for that. But
you don't have to apologize.
It wasn't on my radar.
All right. Thank you.
Are you admitting that there's error in this case? And now the question is, should we reverse this because it's error and impropriety on the part of the judge? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that it was not the best practice to release those jurors prior to having the Batson challenge. And so I'm not going to concede and say that that's...
But what do we do with that? What do we do with that issue? Because if the judge should not have done that, and I think everybody in this room agrees, he should not have released those jurors before he heard that challenge.
And I don't think he does it anymore, by the way.
Okay. Good.
Sorry, just had to get
that. But it biases the decision-making process. Normally, we defer to the findings of fact of a district court judge on assessing prosecutorial racism in making a peremptory challenge. Normally, we say we'd give great deference to the district court and his or her, you know, so on and so forth. How could we possibly give deference to a finding where bias is front-loaded into it because you've already released them and it's going to be an incredible nightmare to sort this out if it can be done at all, footnote 5 of Brass notwithstanding. So the judge is it's no longer even. And so I don't know what we do with that. We're not set up to evaluate in the first instance a Batson challenge. It's a factual thing that you have to look at the people, you have to have familiarity with the dynamic in the courtroom. That's why we defer ordinarily. I don't think it would be appropriate to you for us to say we're going to evaluate this deferentially. his determination on jurors 906, 920, and 931?
Well, Justice, I would respectfully say that you do this on certain situations when you find over a district court's determination racial motivation in the Batson.
We do, but here I'm asking, do you agree that in this case it would be inappropriate for us to review this deferentially, the determination with respect to these three jurors?
I don't know if you have to give it deference. I think that you can look at the facts yourself. I think I've just discussed them. We've gone to them. We've done over them.
So you would agree that we, in evaluating this, should say, because he acted inappropriately in discharging the jury before allowing the Batson hearing, we as a court, reviewing court, should not and are not obligated to review it deferentially, even though we would in other cases, the existence of racial animus?
To the extent that you afford in other cases, that I would say you provide the same amount. And that in that deferential, in the face of that deferential preference, you, the court, sometimes find differently
right from
the court. So I believe that you can use that same deference, or the lack thereof, to look over the shoulder, in essence, and say, based on the record, because the record is not the judge. The answers by the state are the answers by the state, and the answers by the witness. And so deference, as far as the judge, you've got the answers. You can look at those answers and say, were those racially motivated reasons, or were they not? And if they're not, with deference or without deference, there's no need to reverse this. And we must retreat from this, because structural errors in the most uncommon of situations, the Supreme Court cases speak to that effect. And I've got my only dog in the fight here. I keep going back to that footnote. How could a court provide a remedy if, in fact, it's structural? That remedy is available. And we can do like Justice Douglas is saying, bring back the same race or ethnicity of those individuals, and then everybody starts from ground zero and then can ask their questions. And then we can remedy the situation.
Is it correct that this jury was sworn and impaneled before the Batson record was made?
I don't remember. I apologize.
Okay, because Justice Hardesty was asking about that, and
got to be honest, I don't remember. I'll defer to
you. Because that would be the point at which jeopardy attaches, right? On this.
Yes. I would assume that they were sworn in before the two Batson challenges, because one of them was not.
Right, I understand.
But my recollection on this issue, and I mean, she'll probably have the site. She'll be able to solve that issue. But I don't recall. But even if it has attached, it doesn't require reverse.
Let's say analytically I agree with you that, while wrong, it didn't amount to structural error to release those two jurors in advance of the hearing. We held in Brass that it was structural error, and Mr. Brass got his conviction reversed. How could we, with the same judge, the same mistake, and Brass on the books, tell Mr. Bradford, sorry, we're rethinking this. Brass got off, but you're still facing death penalty?
Well, I think you can, because there were no racial motivations for the exercise of those challenges. And I would say that sometimes the ball bounces in your favor and sometimes it doesn't. And this sounds flippant, but I don't mean it that way. Mr. Bradford has benefited from the very thing you've just described, and the state of Nevada didn't, because the defendant is facing death in part because he's got another murder case. And that murder occurred in 2003. It's Julius Bradford with a different victim. In 2004, he was tried and convicted. In 2005, this court determined Bolden. In 2006, Bolden was applied retroactively to Mr. Bradford, even though at the time I tried it, it wasn't in place, and reversed. In 2007, the state took it back to trial, convicted him. He got a second bite at the apple. In 2008, this court, in a similar situation, retreated from Bolden with Cortinas. And then I didn't get the benefit of that law, because in reality, I wouldn't have to try him a second time. And it seems flippant, and I don't mean it that way, Justice, but sometimes it breaks your way, sometimes it doesn't. He's had 24 jurors in this other case, and 12 in this case. I didn't know if there were any other questions. If not, Justice, if I could, Justice Cherry, I would point you to the response answering brief, page 30. You were talking about the lack of an opportunity to ask racially motivated or racial questions. There were 11 jurors that were asked questions during the voir dire process. As you indicated, Judge Herndon made the determination as to the questionnaire and then said, hey, when you're in trial, you have the opportunity. That's the evidence there.
And you told Judge Smith that didn't you, as the prosecutor, as an officer of the court? As an officer of the court, I want to tell you that Judge Herndon said we could ask these questions.
I don't remember doing that, Justice. But we didn't stop when they asked these questions. There's cites to 11 jurors that are asked racial questions, questions about race. They weren't prevented from asking those. Now, some types of questions, and in particular, the portion that I just read to you was when defense counsel was asking about mitigation. And they wanted to get into mitigation, and we were objecting, saying, you can't get into mitigation now. You can't say, literally the question was, what would you like to hear? That was the question. And we objected as far as the context of not imposing the death penalty. And so they were allowed to ask many questions. When they were inappropriate legally, we made objections, upheld sometimes they're not upheld.
What's the case that says it's inappropriate on voir dire to ask about mitigation? What's that case? I'd like to read that case.
Okay, they talked about comparative analysis, and they wanted to go into comparative analysis. And so if we get into, like, what is it that you would like? That's not a case. We cited to us the rule 7.70, which is where you can't give hypotheticals to a juror and say, well, what if this? Would that be something that would come back to you and affect you? They were asking what kind of things you'd like to hear in mitigation. And it's inappropriate for the defense to do that, because think about it. How does the state respond? If they start asking me about those questions, I can't say, well, guess what? You might hear about another murder. But game over at that point. If I respond and I say there are aggravators in conjunction with mitigators, there are aggravators. I can't tell them what the aggravators are.
I think that's a good argument for making the structural error, what you just said. To me, that this points to it as to why we have to stick with Brass and not overrule it. And I think the only way to sustain this conviction is to overrule Brass. It will depend on how my colleagues feel about that as to whether we should overrule Brass.
And obviously the state's position, respectfully, is that you should. Hopefully I've answered all the questions. If not, I will sit down.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, you have about 7 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And the first question I have is about the smokes marijuana daily claim. Talk to me about that.
I'm a little troubled by the state's comments that juror was the only person who said that on the questionnaire. I think you have to look at the questionnaire. Questionnaire asked, because we had a decedent who had huge high levels of meth in his blood. We had other people who were co-conspirators, charged or uncharged, who were using methamphetamine. And so drugs were an issue in this case, as was race. So there were questions about drugs. There were questions about, do you feel that people that use drugs commit crimes? But questions along those lines. In the context of that, that particular juror said, yes, I think drugs can lead to crimes, but not marijuana, because I smoke it daily. Which I think was his way of saying, I smoke marijuana daily, but I'm not a criminal, so I don't, you know, see that marijuana has a nexus. But we did not ask on the questionnaire if people smoke marijuana daily, nor would we be able to under any circumstance that I can think that a judge would find that a proper question. Because if we ask on the questionnaires if people smoke marijuana, then we would get to ask if they take Loratab. Then we would get to ask if they take Valium. Then we would get to ask if they take Ativan. And you can't do that. These are your HIPAA rules that prevent us from asking about the personal drug use of the jurors. So I'm kind of appalled that the state is suggesting that, you know, this somehow, you know, we got to the bottom of all of it and this is the only juror who used marijuana. That's not the case at all. He just happened to respond to a question about drugs in the criminal justice system and his beliefs about whether it impacted it with the statement that he used marijuana.
You're making a comparative juror analysis, and no one else had that volunteered information. And we're, you know, the people have tried and failed repeatedly from Justice Marshall to say Batson you should have to demonstrate cause rather than have peremptories. But you have a peremptory challenge here, and the fact that somebody fills out a questionnaire and volunteers in writing,
I smoke
marijuana daily, is pretty bizarre.
I think what I'm saying is that I agree with Mr. Pesci that nobody else said that on a questionnaire, but that's because we didn't ask, and that's because we couldn't.
So there's no comparative juror analysis for that. You may not like the reason, but that's not a comparative juror analysis.
perhaps that perhaps you're right on that, Justice Pickering. Yes, I don't, I mean, I, because I do agree that you can't make a comparison because we didn't ask if other people smoked marijuana, and then I would certainly take the position that we also get to ask about other things that could potentially impair a juror. I mean, jurors are asked generally if there's any reason they can't serve. And they're asked if, and a lot of people do say they had surgery, they're on medication, they get tired during the day. People do say things like that. This particular juror didn't say that he was impaired in any way. And I, you know, obviously probably don't have to tell this court that I disagree with Mr. Pesci's analysis of the impairment impact of smoking marijuana daily. I don't think that there's any evidence that suggests that someone who smokes marijuana daily is unable to be a juror and a be fair and impartial and follow the law, to pay attention to the proceedings, which is what's required. I don't remember who asked it, but I think it was you, Justice Pickering. The panel was, they were impaneled, but they were actually not sworn until we came back. Judge?
Thank you.
He was in a big hurry to get this done. I had oral argument in San Francisco on Friday, and he had already agreed that I would be able to have half of Thursday off to travel and to be in San Francisco on Friday, so we would have continued jury selection on Monday. So he was worried about the length of time from Wednesday to Monday. He didn't want to swear them because he thought we might lose some people. But he had impaneled 16 jurors.
And so were the others excused? Was the rest?
They were all excused.
Everybody except those who were going to serve?
Then they were excused as well. They were all sent away. And the people that he called their names off, those were the dismissed jurors, including the two challenged jurors, 920 and 913, were told to go down to the clerk's office. Then he explained to the 16 remaining that they would be on the jury, that he wasn't going to swear them, I think were his words, because he wanted to do that Monday in case something happened over a five-day gap. And then we came back on, and then they left, and then he let us make the Batson challenges, and then we came back on Monday. He did swear them.
Do you agree with Mr. Pesci that the questionnaire was sworn under oath or penalty of perjury?
Yes, it does state you're answering these questions under oath. I do not.
And do they say under penalty of perjury at the end when they sign it?
I do not think it says penalty of perjury. He can probably pull one up. I do not agree that that's the equivalent of giving people an oath before they're in a courtroom setting where they're answering questions, and I don't agree that that's a continuing oath. Because those questionnaires
cites that, though, in non-Nevada case law in this area, that the fact there was a questionnaire where they swore under penalty of perjury is...
Right. But then we ask different questions in the courtroom that usually stem from those questionnaires. And we lose a lot of jurors. A lot of them don't... we agreed on several that we could say could be dismissed because they had vacations where they had sick parents or sick children. I mean, what we ended up with, those questionnaires were filled out at least a month, maybe 2 months prior to us actually doing the jury selection. So I want to comment on, obviously, I do not think this court should walk away from Brass. As I said earlier, I don't think that there should be a Julius Bradford exception to Brass, to a fair trial, to equal protection in a death penalty case. I don't think that would be appropriate at all. And I don't think that this case is any different than Brass. As I indicated, it's worse than Brass. And I could understand if the court felt like, gosh, it's a shame sometimes when a jurist makes an innocent mistake and we have to reverse, but it wasn't innocent. He knew what was happening. The court knew what we wanted to make, and that was a Batson challenge. We had already made one. I know I've gone over my time, and I apologize.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Thank you, especially for your spirited argument in this matter. The briefs were excellent. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much, and we're in recess, I think, until 1:30.